maximum resources.
I will tell you a quick story about that song. About a week and a half ago, I was singing it. Yes. That band is gone. That's what came in my head, so I was singing it. Well, I was on my roof fixing it, which was... And the last line was...
Okay. Just a reminder, if you haven't signed in, if you could at least do that before you leave today, I would much appreciate that. If you don't know me, I'm Teresa Hill, City Administrator here. We've had some wonderful people volunteer to come and present and maybe answer some of your questions on some flood mitigation efforts here. We're going to start with some quick introductions. Judd, if you want to start.
Sure. I'm Judd Schultz. I'm the Housing Director with Minnesota Valley Action Council.
Cecile Strauss. I'm with the DNR Floodplain Program, State Floodplain Manager. I'm on the regulatory side.
Christy Delvo with Minnesota Hazard or Emergency Management. I'm the Hazard Mitigation Officer.
Nikki Anderson, also with Minnesota's Homeland Security and Emergency Management. I'm the Hazard Mitigation Planner.
Name's Matt Bauman. I'm the program lead for the state's Flood Hazard Mitigation Grant Assistance Program.
Okay. So what I would like to do, kind of the format, is we'll give our presenters all an opportunity to give their information, and then after we're all done with that, if I have some time, we'll do some question and answer. So hopefully they'll be able to answer a lot of your questions through the presentation, but at the end we'll open it up for questions. Okay? We're going to go ahead and start with Judd first.
I'm just going to talk about some financial assistance that's available through our agency that we can help people with. The first money is actually, we have a current small cities development program grant in the community, and we did not spend all the money, and it was going to end at the end of September here. And we reached out to our funding source and asked them if we could extend it another year, and they agreed to do that. Now, this program isn't specifically for disaster relief or to deal with flooded houses or anything like that, but what it can do is it does some general rehab. But if you're in the target area and you're eligible for the program, I have to follow all the program rules, which means I have to come out and do an inspection, I have to do a lead assessment and that. But if you have some flood damage that we could use to fix with that program, that's great. We can probably fit that in somehow. The program provides $25,000, up to $25,000 in assistance, 0% interest, 10-year deferred loan. So no interest, no monthly payments, a lien's put on the property for 10 years. If you live there for 10 years, goes away. That's your repayment. You live in the property for 10 years. If you sell, transfer, assign that property any time within that 10 years, the funds actually get repaid to the City of Waterville. And they have a revolving fund that those go in, and then they can help people again with that money. But once again, it's not specifically for disaster relief, but if you're in the target area and you're eligible, I have to follow all my other rules, but if you have damage from the flooding, I might be able to address that and the like. So we do have a target area. You see the bright colors there, that's the area we are operating in as far as our target area. And the income limits, there is an income limit with the program, and it's 80% of area median based on household size. So a household of one could make $61,350 a year. A household of four can make $87,600. So pretty generous income limits. And then it is designed for owner-occupied property. So it have to be owner-occupied for us to assist in that program. I have money for about five projects. And so how we will approach that is, I have application packets that I'm going to leave here at the city. If you're interested, you grab one. You want to get your stuff back right away, there's an application. There's a list of items you need to supply with your application, and there's a bunch of other forms that you need to sign. My staff person that works with that is sort of a rules guy, so he's going to go through packets he gets, and if you don't have everything in it and somebody else does, he's going to take the one that has everything in it. So all I can say is make sure that if you're interested in that program, you grab a packet, you fill out the information, you provide all the stuff that's asked for. And then, like I say, we have about 5 projects that we can do. The money needs to be spent by September 30th of 2025. So we'll be working on that. So that's just it's nice that they extended that program for us so we could at least make those funds available. The other program I have is called the Disaster Recovery Loan Program. So we are a contract lender for our friends at Minnesota Housing, and they asked us to make these funds available. They're a little behind the eight ball. Usually we are here when FEMA's here, but they weren't quite ready to go with that this year. This program will provide up to $30,000 to put your property back in pre-flood condition. So it's not necessarily a mitigation program, but it's putting your property back the way it was. Have reached out to Minnesota Housing and asked some questions, just knowing some of the situations in town here where properties that were elevated have to be elevated more. Can this money potentially help with that? So they're considering those things at this point in time. This can be, it's for residential properties, so homeowners, but it can also address rental properties. If you're using it for rental property, there's some additional things that come into play there about keeping rents affordable for 5 years and things like that, but you could use it on rental property also. It's a 10-year deferred loan, so again, 0% interest, no monthly payments, liens put on the property for 10 years, and as long as you own that property for 10 years, and if it's single family owned and occupied as your principal place of residence, then the loan's forgiven. If you end up having to repay it, this money does go back to the state of Minnesota. They use those repayments then to refund the program and make those disaster funds available for other entities. No income limits on this program, so that's sort of nice. There is a hierarchy to this assistance. You need to have filed an insurance claim. You need to have applied for FEMA, and you need to have applied for SBA. And you're going to need to provide that information. So whatever it is, if you file an insurance claim, but they said, no, we can't cover you for that, we need a copy of that denial. If you applied for FEMA and they gave you some money, we need to know what that money was for, whether it was personal property or for property rehab and how much it was, and then the same thing with SBA. So whether you were denied or whatever you got. And this is designed to be sort of that last line of help, trying to meet the needs that aren't being covered by those other forms of assistance. The nice thing about this program is you can reimburse yourself for costs you've already incurred. You just have to provide receipts, and so we can document that. But it's all tied to repairing the property. It's not for personal property items, but it's just putting that property back in a pre-flood condition. So again, I've got packets that I'll leave here at the city that they'll be available. Application, a list of other items we need, and then a needs assessment where you go through and identify how much water you had and things like that. Essentially, those packets will come back to me, and how we'll probably start with that is I'll be reaching out to you if you apply and just going through that needs assessment and walking through the whole process at that point. But that's a nice program. I think we have until, it's open until February, I believe. Yep, deadline to apply is February 28th, 2025. So that does give you time. If you didn't file that insurance claim or didn't apply for FEMA or SBA, it gives you time. You need to do that first before you apply for this. So that gives you a little bit of time. I know FEMA extended their deadline to the end of October. Correct, I think. Anybody know for sure?
October 27th.
October 27th. So if you haven't applied, you have basically 3 weeks to get that done. And that's how I would do that. If you haven't done those three things yet, get that done first and then apply for this. As far as we know, they're not going to run out of money with this. So if you end up the money will be there through their application period. And like I say, it's up to $30,000, which is pretty nice, and the no income limits and the like, and for rental properties, just that rental property has a few more requirements with it. So hopefully, one or both of them, and we could use both of these together if we had to. So you might be able to get the small cities loan, which is $25,000, but potentially $20,000 of that is going to be on other things I have to do that are required by the program. And there's a little bit for flood, but you have more damage than that. Well, this disaster recovery loan could come into play then after behind that and do that. So we could combine these together. So that's what I got. And like I say,
thank you.
The white one is small cities, the yellow one is disaster recovery, and I have a bunch for both, and I'll just leave them there at the seat.
Thank you, Jeff. Our next presenter is going to be Nikki.
Okay. Is that the mics for recording purposes, or are those the only mics?
Those are the only mics.
Okay, I'll try just.
It'll pick up, it's pretty good.
Okay.
Your programs are both state ones, right?
Of course.
Your programs are both state.
This is actually federal dollars that come through the state, and these are state dollars.
Okay.
That's why this
happens. Everyone can see that? Okay. So I'm, again, Nikki Anderson with HSEM. We deal with FEMA's grant, so they set eligibility requirements, this kind of stuff. I'm focused on mainly, the type of mitigation projects that are available to homeowners through their programs, and then programs specifically are, it kind of varies whether or not you have insurance and that kind of stuff. So I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritties of that with this presentation, just focus more on the project types that are available. Okay, so when it comes to funding and eligibility, homeowners must work with, Teresa here, or you lived in the townships, you work with the county, that kind of stuff. Some of the programs, do require NFIP flood insurance. A private policy would not work. It would have to be through the NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program. There are some programs where you don't need that flood insurance policy. But for the ones that do require it, like Swift Current, you could potentially get a higher cost share, because the standard cost share is typically a 75% federal and 25% local. So there is that slight variability. When it comes to the actual activities themselves, the highest priority at the state is looking at acquisitions, whether it's demolition or relocation. The caveat with relocations is it costs more, so it might not be a benefit cost analysis ratio of one or above, or there's the additional issue where if your house keeps being damaged, a contractor might not find it safe to relocate that structure. So there's some caveats to relocation. So we usually opt and prefer demolitions, just for easier cost-benefit analysis. Then there's also structure elevations. I know there's been some interest here. Waterville in the past has had some experience with it. Not everyone's going to need a VCA of one or above for that. So we got to be a little careful with that. And with the lower ones, those tend to not meet VCA requirements within the state, but they are a possibility that we could look into, whether it's that dry flood proofing, non-structural retrofitting, raising utilities off the ground, that kind of stuff. And then moving forward, I'll talk more about the type of projects themselves, so that way you have a better understanding of what this slide's talking about. So with acquisitions, you know, there's a pre-event valuation or assessed valuation. So if your property was, you know, if your structure was damaged, you would get that pre-event valuation. It's not going to be based off of, you know, what its state is in right now, even if you've been doing work on it. And then, like, the city of Waterville would be acquiring that property, and then it gets deed-restricted to open space. And then there is, again, the option of demolition or relocation. And then another caveat with relocations is it needs to be on a plot of land that's going to be out of a hazard-prone area, whether it's out of the flood zone, out of a landslide-prone or erosion-prone area. So that's another issue that would need to be tackled if you're looking at a relocation. Structural elevation, you know, it's typical, raise the structure up, you know, there could be, you know, continuous foundation walls, you know, elevating on open foundations, pile structures, that kind of stuff, converting second stories. One thing I would like to keep in mind, if you're looking at elevation and if you're gonna allow water to flow under or into like the basement or something, remember that people tend to have basements as their tornado shelters, so you would want to make sure that, like, you have some sort of safety if there's a tornado to be coming in place, because you don't want there to be flooding and a tornado is at the same time when it comes to that kind of stuff. And all these projects, like, moving forward, there's a deed restriction to the property that occurs that requires you to have flood insurance. So the nice thing about acquisitions is you don't have to deal with that deed restriction of keeping flood insurance, whereas like elevations, all that kind of stuff, you would be required to have flood insurance on that property for the life of the property. For floodproofing, if it's a historical residential structure or a non-residential structure, there's the possibility of dry floodproofing. That's just, you know, combination of measures that result in a non-residential structure, including the attendant utilities and equipment, being watertight with all elements substantially impermeable to the entrance of flood water, and with structural components having the capacity to resist flood, like, you know, having concrete walls and tiles. Carpet is going to get racked if it gets wet and that kind of stuff. And then for non-residential structures, there's also, you know, a wet floodproofing approach using flood damage resistant materials. Again, wouldn't want to be using carpet because that would get damaged. That kind of stuff, you know, minimizing damage. It doesn't eliminate the damage, it just minimizes it, which is why that benefit cost analysis is harder to reach with these type of projects. And again, deed restricted for flood insurance. Then non-structural retrofitting, this would be for existing buildings and facilities, you know, kind of like what you can see in those pictures. You're basically just raising up utilities to kind of get it out of that where it's going to flood, so that way they don't get damaged. And this could be done in conjunction with structural retrofits, which that is the next one. There we go. So for structural retrofitting, again, this is for existing buildings, used to address structural deficiencies in existing buildings and structures. You know, your house may have been, you know, built in the 60s. There's way different building standards of today. So that's where this would be kind of looking at, you know, trying to figure out where those deficiencies are between the codes of then to the codes of today, and trying to get it up to more modern code. And again, deed restrict. Mitigation reconstruction. So if the structure and or the foundation was partially or completely demolished or destroyed, this would be kind of an option to look at. So basically, again, just trying to build the structure back up and trying to bring it into compliance. But again, you need that like existing structure and foundation to have that damage. And again, deed restricted. Okay. And then you said questions at the end.
Okay. I'm coming at this not knowing to what extent the city's still viewing on potential acquisition project. Some of what I'll talk about kind of duplicates what Nikki talked about, but really my program is a state-funded program, and the flood hazard mitigation program, it was established by the legislature. It's been around since like 87. We spend most of our money on big infrastructure projects to protect a lot of the communities in Minnesota. But in addition to that, we've also partnered with FEMA on a lot of projects and also bought out a lot of structures just using state funds through cost share. Statewide, we partnered on buyouts for over 3,600 structures in the state. Buyouts are a big part of mitigation. It's our highest priority. We consider it our most effective form of mitigation. You're removing risk permanently from the floodplain. And a lot of times a community can't accommodate for like an infrastructure project, and really the most realistic form of mitigation is just getting the structures out of there. Realistically though, it's a voluntary program and it requires buy-in from the property owners. So, you know, unfortunately that buy-in, there might be different times when somebody wants to pursue a buyout. Potentially the city's pursued a buyout for quite some time, but we find the most interest after disasters come, and you know, homeowners are left with very few options. So here we are. So the program, it requires a one-to-one match, and that match can come from any non-state fund. You know, it can come from locals, it can come from the community, it can come from FEMA. So a limitation of the program is it's bond fund money, so it must be publicly owned. So the work must be tangible, you know, and BIOS is a tangible project. And it must occur on a publicly owned piece of property. So the property must be bought out and owned by the city in perpetuity. So that's a limitation. We wouldn't be able to partner with FEMA on a retrofitting project, an elevation project. We do partner with them on relocation projects. So typically most of our projects, most of the projects statewide really are just outright demolition. A handful might be relocated if the home is still in good condition, but for the most part we're looking at demolition, and probably FEMA is too realistically. I
don't really have much time.
Yeah, so this is kind of what I already said. It's a high priority. We funded a lot of these statewide. So there's a process. You know, it's probably taking you a while to figure out what your options are, and you know, to land on acquisitions as a realistic alternative. So the city might have worked with you on substantial damage assessments. Seal mentioned that she's here on a regulatory capacity. Nationwide, communities have a responsibility to regulate substantial damage, you know, and that's basically if your property is damaged beyond 50% of the structure's value, it can't be rebuilt unless it's in compliance. And you know, you're telling a property owner that's just lost everything that they have to spend more money to get their house into compliance. It's a message that no community wants to deliver. Well, buyouts give these property owners kind of an option, you know, particularly if they don't carry a flood insurance policy. You know, they don't have the funds to do that kind of thing. Well, a buyout offers an opportunity. Like Nikki said, that there's a price, and that's determined based on the pre-damaged assessed or appraised value. Nikki introduced a number of different grant programs. Realistically, the grant program that you'd probably be looking at is HMGP. That's the federal FEMA grant program, HMGP. Those funds are made available after a presidential disaster declaration, and they would fund 75% of the buyout expenses. You know, so you homeowners, you're interested in the price. You know, what do you get for it? You know, city, you're certainly interested in what else comes with that. You know, that would also pay for demolition expenses, hazmat, asbestos, and some limited funds for administration too. 75% comes from FEMA. The state, when the state has funds, I should add, the state does not have funds right now. When the state has funds, I hope to get funds with the next legislative session. The state partners for half of the non-federal share, 12.5%. The remaining 12.5%, the community sometimes partners, sometimes the homeowner covers that 12.5%. It's really up to the community, since the community would be the applicant. The community would be applying to FEMA on behalf of the homeowner. The community would be applying to the state on behalf of the homeowners. The next item is important. Sometimes a homeowner might be interested, well, if the house is demolished, like, why not just get it out of there? It's a health hazard, it's a safety hazard, let's just demolish it. An important point, and this applies to both FEMA and state funds, is no activities are reimbursable unless they occur after funds are allocated. So that means that a home is sitting in a deteriorated state, which is not ideal, but that's just the way it is. And government moves slow, so there's not really a way around that. Timelines. So Teresa knows this, and there's a process for applying to FEMA funds, and Nikki didn't really touch on this. But there's a notice of interest that the city is required to submit for priority funding for a buyout. So, Teresa's aware of this. If the community is interested in pursuing a buyout project, this would be a collection of different homeowners that are going to the city and at least verbally saying, yes, I would like to proceed with a buyout of my property. The city then submits a notice of interest, which is due by November 15th, short notice, for priority funding. I'm kind of driving out of my lane right now because I'm talking about FEMA funding. I don't anticipate, there may be opportunities for additional funding under this presidential disaster declaration after November 15th, but, all indications are that the city has interest in moving forward with the project, and for priority funding that would have to be submitted before November 15th. So realistically, that's not a firm commitment by any property owner. It's not a firm commitment by the city by November 15th. That's a notice of interest. That's getting your foot in the door for those funds. That helps the federal government determine the total money appropriated to the state as part of the presidential disaster declaration, and then they can figure out the total funds that go to the state. But that NOI is key, getting the foot in the door before that date. So if you're an interested property owner, I would communicate that to the city well before that date so they can get an NOI in. Realistically, the next two bullets, it's kind of tough to say. After a notice of interest is submitted, then FEMA formally invites the city to submit a full application. And at that point, you're kind of looking at more commitments, and the city would probably pass a resolution for funding this thing as part of the application process. This would likely come in spring. And property owners would need to be on board again during the time of application. And in spring, application would probably go to the state and FEMA right around the same time. This is when the legislature is in session. There's already been discussion of funding a bonding bill this next year. It's usually done an even number of years. We didn't pass a bonding bill last year. So there's a lot of legislators that are very motivated to pass a bonding bill this next year. So, you know, hopefully we'll get one, and hopefully the flood hazard mitigation program is a part of that. Based on what I'm hearing, that's my hope anyway. So if it's funded, realistically, that probably wouldn't be awarded until summer, and then transfer of ownership, we're looking at sometime after that, depending on how fast we can move on the grant. But, you know, we're the government, and we move very slowly, and that's just a part of the business with the government, I guess. That's all I have.
Sure, I can make a few comments here. Basically, I work with the city on helping them to enforce their floodplain regulations. They have a floodplain ordinance that says for new construction, we have to build this high and these kind of standards. When we have floods or other disasters, also includes tornadoes and other things, if it impacts a building that's in the mapped floodplain area, the special flood hazard area, or the commonly called the 100-year floodplain, then the ordinance that the city has applies, and the city is required to check the houses and say, was this damaged by more than 50%? And when they're looking at that, they're looking at the value of the building itself without the property value, and they're looking at the market value, not necessarily the replacement costs. So that's part of the process that the city's been going through. And then if you do get a letter from the city saying you've done the evaluation, your building was damaged by more than 50%, that's officially called a substantially damaged building, then if you're rebuilding, then you have to either elevate the house or do the allowed kinds of floodproofing on the lower part of the house. Basically at the flood elevation plus a foot and a half, you'll range. And so you're either elevating on a fill or you're elevating so that you've got the outside walls that are flood resistant and have openings that will automatically open. There's some specific standards on how you can build that. You can't, if you have a basement, you'd have to be filling in what's below ground. You can't have any area below the ground, crawl space or lookout or full basement. You have to fill in whatever's below ground and have that flood resistant material on the part that's above ground. You could elevate your house so you get at least enough room to have a tuck under garage, because you also can't have habitable space on that flood proof lower area. You can have parking and storage, which is why a lot of people will lift up the house just enough to be able to use it for your parking, because that's an allowable use and a good use for that lower area. So as we get into the details of particular properties, we help the city with looking at what your options are. I'll also mention flood insurance. If there's flood insurance questions, I can usually help the city and the citizens with those basic questions. I know there were a fair number of people in the city that had flood insurance policies, but unfortunately I know many of you did not. And there have been, I can't share the information, it's private information, but I have been able to look at the claims, and there's been quite a few claims made based on people's flood insurance. Some of them have gotten very nice payouts. That if you do have flood insurance though and you are substantially damaged, you want that letter from the city so that you can give that to your agent and you can get up to $30,000 more for the cost to help pay for doing that elevation of the building or moving it to another site and some of those kinds of things, engraving compliance. It's a rider basically on your flood insurance. It's called the increased cost of compliance rider. The increased cost beyond just building back where you were, that there's going to be some extra costs to go a little higher or to do the demolition and rebuilding someplace else. So those are the areas I get involved with. And I know these guys, so we work together on trying to help define the best fits and helping to work with the community on finding what's the best fit for property owners. But as they said, the acquisitions, buyouts are only done with willing sellers. Nobody's going to say you have to do a buyout.
I think we've covered. Did anybody else want to add anything else before we take a couple questions? Good. Okay. Does anybody have
a question? Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I'm right over here by the water tower. I was one of the first properties and flooded up. I was in a previous floodplain. I've been working with Teresa. She's been great. I've already demolished my house. I don't have a letter from the city on the demolition, but it was in it. And I'm going to rebuild. I'm going to take my elevation up. But my primary concern is I work up in the cities. I live up in the cities. This is not my primary residence. So every recourse I've tried in the past is I'm denied right in the front because it's not my primary residence. So are any of these programs going to help me in my situation being is not my primary residence? Can you give me any insight or direction there?
So since you've already demolished and done work like that,
yep,
that would not be eligible for, because like Matt had said, you have to wait until the project is awarded before you can do work like that.
Okay.
However, we are able to take on secondary homes in that, and do our programs are eligible for secondary homes, which is nice because I was here for the DRC and I was hearing about, like, you know, it had to be primary homes to get IA, but our program at least allows secondary homes to be.
But it wouldn't score as well.
Well, yeah. So when it comes to priorities, primary homes are going to have priority over secondary homes. But yes, there's still a possibility. And we do keep a wait list of projects as well. So if you didn't receive, you know, funding this time around and you're still like willing to do a project in the future, we'll keep it on our wait list.
So like we applied through FEMA, we got out there, we went through the SBA for the low interest loan. We still got denied because it's not our primary residence.
Yeah.
So I see the same thing repeating.
Yeah.
But I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming tonight.
Welcome to the Minnesota House.
Yeah, this is either your primary home or a rental home. So we would cover that secondary home. Okay. So same thing. Okay. Thanks.
So I have a question that probably wasn't addressed that I heard, though. To participate in the programs, do they all have to be 50% damaged, or could they just be looking for something that, try to not get into that situation where you would be 50% damaged?
They don't have to be substantially damaged. Some of our programs, like Swift Current, if you had to be eligible for that particular program, you have to be have an NFIP policy that's in effect. And you would need to have that repetitive loss, severe repetitive loss, or of substantially damaged status. But for other programs that don't require as stringent of eligibility requirements, if the property has a history, and we can look at a floodplain map and see, hey, yeah, your house is at a risk, right? As long as we can identify the hazard, it wouldn't need to be substantially damaged to be eligible for our hazard mitigation assistance funding through FEMA. But it just might help with certain being eligible for
certain programs.
Yeah, if there's flood risk, it's eligible, as far as I'm concerned.
I have a question. So right now, it's not our primary resident. We have over 50% damage. But if it was, if we were planning to move here and it becomes our primary resident, is there any help for that? We don't have any insurance, and it's not our primary residence. So then what do we do?
Well, again, our program still takes on secondary homes. It's just whether or not it gets prioritized before primary homes. That's basically how that winds up.
So if you have a big enough pot of money, you might have enough for secondary homes.
Yeah.
But if you've got a limited pot of money,
yeah,
the priority is
primary.
I'm going to look at your date of application, and if it's your primary residence when you apply, then I can help. But if it's not,
okay. And we have until November to make it our primary?
Yeah, that's probably the issue. We'd have to figure that out, how we could phrase that. That would be, you have to own and occupy, unless if it is a rental property, you can use the disaster recovery.
Why is that? I mean, why don't they help people with secondary homes?
This money, the Small Cities Development Program money, is HUD funded. It's HUD money that comes down to the state, and you have to meet a federal objective. And so the current application that was extended is serving low and moderate income households, and so that it has to be owner occupied. Slum and Blight would do commercial. And then the state one is our state housing finance agency. For whatever reason, for this disaster recovery program, it's owner-occupied or rental. The state has never looked at secondary homes on any of their programs, whether it's rehab or purchase or anything.
Yeah, which is crazy, because I know I pay more taxes because it's not my primary home.
Yep.
So I pay probably almost double the tax because it's not, that goes to state and federal government.
Yep.
Okay. But
yeah, I don't make the decisions on how
they
fund them.
No, I understand.
One more general question, kind of drawing on your guys' experience in the field. We talked about the second home mitigation, having enough money, because nobody wants to pay more taxes, so if the money's not available, we understand that and everything else. But looking back over the history of these programs, in the last 10 to 20 years, has there been a major swing in funding? Funding has gone down? I'm assuming that funding has gone down in the last 10, 12 years. So odds of this funding being available are less likely now than what they were 12 years ago? I'm just asking a hypothetical question based on the experience and the track records that you guys may have seen.
On the programs I end up working with, like the disaster recovery money through Minnesota Housing, that's been evolving over the years. Probably, 2016? Were we here and we had some of this money? I mean, we did a elevation project that was separate from that, but we also had this money. It was underneath a different program name. It's evolved a little bit. It just depends.
More
if there's a whole bunch of disasters, the state then they'll change the maximum amount that you can borrow and stuff like that, depending upon the money they have in the pool. The small cities money has been pretty consistent over the years. What they haven't done is they haven't kept up with the times on the rehab needs. So the dollar amount that we can put into a property is $25,000. Every other rehab program we work with is up to $37,500. And they just haven't kept up with that. So we're really limited on what we can do.
Fair enough.
I remember in 2012, it was, you had a cap of only $10,000.
Right.
And so it has increased over time. The other thing is for the federal, the grant that Nikki was talking about, the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program, the way they calculate how much in that pot is they look at what was the total documented damage from this declaration, from this disaster, for public assistance and individual assistance. And they take, 15%? 15% gets set aside as this grant money. So it's totally dependent on how big the disaster is, and that hasn't changed over time.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bonkers?
We have we live in one of the floodplains. We're right on the bay. And the only reason our house didn't get destroyed is because my sons and their friends and a host of other people, we sandbagged. We had over 4 feet of sandbags around our house. Between everybody's help and the pumps, our house didn't get hurt. But it seems like because we saved the house, there's nothing available for us. I want to have this thing jacked, or at least find out what we can or can't do, because we live so close to the lake. I don't know what I can or can't do.
You can voluntarily elevate your house. You could work with the city on what design you would have. I'm guessing that it's a house that was built before the current regulations.
65 so you, or something. You
definitely
like
before the regulations. So you can voluntarily elevate your house, even if you weren't substantially damaged. And it's something we'd certainly encourage to reduce your risk now, because we know it's not a matter of if there's another flood, it's a matter of when and how high it gets.
That's why I'm here. Because I'm trying to decide what to do.
Yeah.
You know, do we see if I can't just get rid of the house?
Yeah.
We don't want to because we really like where we live. If I bring it up, now this flood would have hit the floor. We would have probably had maybe 2 inches all across my house, but we were able to keep it out. So we thought if I could bring it up a couple of blocks. It's a crawl space under it now, and I was going to jack it up. But I was just trying to figure out anything I've ever went online and tried to find that with FEMA money or state money. If my house would have been wrecked, then I have stuff available, but it's not. You know, even when the FEMA guy come down to look, there wasn't enough damage that, you know, it was kind of like, what are you whining about, you know? I didn't have a lot of damage to the house, just a flood mess, and that's not what I'm looking for money for. I want to, if there's anything available, to jack this thing, or maybe it is a buyout we have to end up with because of where our location is.
Well, to your point, you could help 10 houses elevate their homes $30,000 each versus demolishing
one for $300,000.
So where's the proactiveness
of these owners? They want the houses out of the floodplain. They see all houses in floodplain as a risk. And FEMA is in the red because they provide assistance to the same structures over and over and over again.
Can there be programs now that people look out that you want to have an educated pay?
Well, I know like some cities, like planners have kept in touch with, I don't know about this specific jurisdiction, but I know some city planners for other jurisdictions have kept in touch with people in the special flood hazard area, which is like the 100-year floodplain, because they know that, because they are trying to like get those homes acquired. And that's when like that benefit cost analysis, why acquisitions are, you know, so easy to get that benefit cost analysis, because we're not worried about like, you know, if we're doing it to a little bit above the 100-year floodplain, you still have a 500-year flood or then some, like you're still gonna get damaged. Like, there's still a risk. So that's why the benefit cost analysis is not gonna be as great for something
for elevating versus acquiring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
some
people
can educate people that there is an acquisition
option,
even if it's
not ready to sell
20%
of his homes.
It's just whether or not we kind of have funding at the time when they want to do that. That's the tricky part that we've encountered between our two programs, trying to like work, help people out, because sometimes it isn't right after the disaster,
sure.
Or like a disaster's hit a neighborhood, you know, a different neighborhood, and they're like, oh, that could be us next, or what have you.
I'm assuming that the new floodplain is what we just experienced. It's not the floodplain from 2008 or whatever the last one was, 65, I think, is the one.
Dave, we actually just got new maps in Lesueur County on July 17th. So this event we just had that was, what, 2 feet above our 100-year? That is not reflected in the current maps, and it would be many years before it would be reflected, because they would look at, you know, what flood levels statistically have we gotten to over time. As they get more data over time, the flood elevation will be a little higher, but they don't just automatically go up to this 2 feet above, because they're still looking at what statistically is that 1%.
My house is above the last flood stage.
Okay.
Last time I was at 2, it didn't get to the floor. It got to the garage, but that was it.
Yeah.
Well, if you bring it up another 2 feet, and you know, I think that's where most everybody in the whole town got their problem. You know? There's a lot of people says this. It's never been here. It's never even been to my yard. Well, now you got a flow of water in your house. You know, nobody expected it.
But the official elevation shown on the map won't go up immediately because of this flood. It will be taken into account in the future. But the other thing I want to mention is that if someone is looking at new construction, now you guys are mainly talking about reconstruction, but just making you aware, if someone was doing new construction, HUD, or just issued new regulations a couple months ago saying new reconstruction, they have to be 2 feet above the flood elevation to be eligible for an FHA loan. So that's something we're educating our local officials about, that if someone did want to build on a spot in the floodplain with new construction and they wanted to be able to get an FHA loan, they have to have a 2-foot freeboard, which actually would have helped for this flood. But right now the state minimums a footer freeboard plus up to half a foot, depending on where you are. So the current minimum elevation would not meet that new HUD rule for FHA loans.
Now I know the FEMA that I talked to, and they offered some money for a settlement. And if I accept that money, then I have to have flood insurance on the house for the rest of the address's life. And if anybody's looked at flood insurance, you're talking about $400 a month. It's going to be almost impossible to sell your house.
It is not cheap.
You know,
the average policy is about
$900
to $1,000 a year.
Yeah.
The average policy in Minnesota, and it's once they bring in full risk rates, because they switched the way that they do premiums a couple years ago. People are on a glide path if they already have a policy, but the full risk policy rate is set as an average of $1,800 a year in Minnesota. So you're right, it's not cheap, and that is something that you have to think about if you accept assistance from FEMA.
The understanding I had from FEMA folks right here was that's fine, but if you don't continue the insurance after the insurance period, you don't have to, but you no longer get FEMA assistance in the future.
Yeah.
It's not that you have to.
Officially, you're supposed to carry it.
Correct.
But the stick only comes down if you want
to. But that wasn't clear in a lot of the documentation, a lot of the letters from FEMA. That you're not required, actually, technically, to keep that insurance, but if you don't, you're no longer eligible for future benefits.
I think legally you're officially required to have it, but they don't enforce it if other than that first 3 years.
But it's probably important for citizens to understand
to realize that. That's one of those laws that they're going to ignore, so you can get away with it.
So if you rebuild above floodplain, you would still have to have flood insurance.
If you elevate on fill,
okay. So
your lowest floor and your lowest ground touching the building is above, meeting the minimums for the city, you can apply for basically an insurance waiver from FEMA. It's called a letter of map revision based on fill. Yeah. But if you're doing the elevating on those flood-resistant walls with the openings, you're still officially in the floodplain. And if you've got a federally backed loan of some type, most types of mortgages, most types of secured loans, the lender would be required to have you get flood insurance.
Okay. Does that make sense? Yep.
So my understanding, what you're talking about, was when they were doing it where FEMA was providing you with flood insurance. That is very different from our program, Hazard Mitigation Assistance. We're not giving you any money to start doing flood insurance. We're providing you with assistance for, you know, acquisition, demolition. Those projects, you need to be keeping the flood insurance. That's a very different program, what you're talking about, because I was here.
The people that came here and got questions and got checks.
Yeah.
But the letters we got said, you have to carry flood insurance. Yeah. But when we talked to the FEMA people, they said, yes, you do if you have a loan. Most loans will require you to continue it. However, when I pushed the question and said, the money was in my account before I even knew what happened.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I asked the question, I said, I'm going to give the money back because I don't necessarily want to pay that amount of flood insurance for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll self-insure.
That's very different if you're going with that.
The programs you guys talked about, I understand, that was clear. You guys made it pretty clear.
Because it gets put right into your deed and it states that you have to have it. So there is that requirement for the life of that property moving forward.
If you do an elevation project.
Yeah, through our program, you would have to.
I'm going to be retired soon. You know, I'm actually old enough to be retired, and I'm not. But when I do, now I'm on a fixed income, basically. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to have to take out all my savings and my retirements to pay flood insurance. You know?
And they wouldn't tell us what they wouldn't tell us what it would be. They couldn't tell us. They said, we can't tell you what that insurance will be year to year.
It's just going to keep going up.
We came down here. Those of you that don't know me, I'm the troublemaker in town. I live up on North First Street. I've been in the same house for over 50 years. And I've watched the water come in every year. Sometimes they put a little fountain out there. Sometimes they put a little boat out there. The water's going to come in here and water up. In 14, the water got deep enough that I could touch the corner of my house and reach out and touch the water. My house is slightly elevated. So yes, the crawl space got flooded. Big deal. Now with this last flood, the water came into the garage. Flood insurance would not cover any of my things that got damaged, which included all of my little toys that I had in the garage. It would cover my water heater. It would cover my furnace. But unfortunately, that aid came long after I had already fixed that stuff. So now you can't be compensated because you already paid for it. Now, a few weeks ago, out of the clear blue, I got a check for a ridiculous amount of money because my application had been approved. I didn't apply for anything. I came down here the last day that the office was open here from FEMA. And in a nutshell, if you don't use this money, you won't be eligible for flood insurance. You won't be eligible for the 3 years of free flood insurance that this individual was talking about. Now, I've been there for 52 years. Let's say that I'm going to spend $2,000 a year. That's $100,000 for something that might never happen. Now, along with your part of the presentation, I understood that there's money available for things like levees. If the government's going to acquire properties, why don't they acquire the properties and build a levee along that river?
You're asking me that?
So there's money available for that. So tell me why we can't apply for that.
I think that's a better question for your city council.
Well,
you don't
the
water, though,
the other aspect is that, that he was pointing out that in the past, the state funds have helped pay for bigger flood control projects. There's no money right now, but the program's been going since, it's been paying out money since 88.
I understand that perfectly, but you know what? Again, I've been here 50 years ago, and I lived here. I grew here in 65, grew up here. In 65, when it flooded, had something been started there, we'd have had a levee. Mm-hmm. We'd have had a dike. It would have been no problem.
I don't know if this is for the city to answer. I don't think any of you guys would be involved.
No, but the thing is, well,
are they doing anything about the, like,
the money is available according to what he said. Why is it that the city has not applied for that money and moved forward on a project like that? The last person that I talked to about it says, well, it takes too long, it's not worth it. Well, I realize that if this were to be started now, I would never see that levee being built. I know that. I'm old.
There's a long wish list for our state grant program to help pay for those levees and blocks of buyouts. Yeah. And, you know, you've got, I don't know how many millions in on the waiting list for getting that.
Go after, you know, because it has to be something that can be done downstream. Like, we do have a dam further down. Just watching the water levels during this flood situation, you know, we were already had water on the streets. And it wasn't even to the medium flood stage in the Morristown Registry. That thing could have took at least another foot of water down the Cannon River.
Exactly.
And the whole, you know, we could have gotten rid of a foot of water before we got the 18 inches of rain, and that would have stopped a lot of damage. But I don't know who you'd even go after. You know, they call it the Schmidtke Dam. That holds back a lot of water. Now, it's all state property back there. I don't know why they don't have like a flood level that, okay, this stuff gets up a foot, now it can go down this channel and then take more water. Not trying to flood out Morristown, but they could have took another foot and a half of water and still not been flooded. Mm-hmm. Why, we were already flooded. And when, so, you know, that's a DNR thing. So I don't know who's in charge of that. And it also throws another wrench into it because that dam is in Rice County, we're in Masuer County. So, you know, I know it's going to be a football to try to get that kicked down the road, but and even going upstream on the Cannon, maybe you got to dam up something up there a little bit because there's a lot of slough north. Maybe slow some of that down, you know, because it's not going to get any better. And it's just part of the way it is. Every farmer out there has tile running in, so you get 6 inches of rain, it's in Tatanka in 5 days or less, where it used to be 2 weeks to get here.
Okay, if you give me a second, I'll address a little bit of that, and then we can try to refocus to just the homeowner part of it, if that would be fine with you guys. So a few years ago, we did start getting a study done on the Cannon River watershed to try to identify areas to do improvements. The county has now picked that up, and you can watch that on our website and the county website on the progress of that study. So there's a study called the Cannon River Watershed Hydraulic Study, okay? Out of that, they're going to be identifying areas of upland storage and other mechanisms that may be beneficial, okay? And then from that, they're hoping to use that then to leverage funding to put these in play. So part of it, in my opinion, is you need the statistical data first to say what you're going to do is not going to cause problems for somebody else. You know, you can't just do something and hope it doesn't.
That's the last thing we want to do is to flood out Morristown and then That's going to go to Faribault, and then that's going to go to Northfield. You know.
Yeah, so the county did have a request in for the bonding bill in order to start working on some upland storage agreements with people to, you know, slow the water down, keep it up before it comes down to us. That wasn't funded. So they are looking at other avenues in order to do that. Part of their problem is when you try to go to, say, Ms. Rogers, if I went to you and say, we want to use this part of your property, but all the funding mechanisms that we have say that you have to pay us 25% of that in order for us to use your property. So the county is working on ways to try to get that financing and stuff together to make it a little more feasible. So it has been in the works, but you know, you might, in my opinion, you need the data to prove what you're going to be doing. And it's not going to be anything really quick. The study is probably about 6 months out yet before it's completed, and that last phases will have some of that information. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested, watch that on, there's a click on our webpage, also the county. Just keep an eye on that, and you'll get updates on that study as it goes. Okay? Okay, so does anybody have any other questions about mitigation for homeowners? Yes, Rich.
I have a question for Judge.
Yeah.
If you don't make your 10 years, what's the interest rate when you have to pay the loan back?
There's no interest rate, so it would just be the funds that you were providing. Yeah. And the,
is it prorated?
State money? No, it's not prorated. So if you borrow like the state money, if you get the full 30 and you're there 8 years and then you have to sell, the full 30 goes back to the state, and small cities money, that goes back to the city. No prorated.
There's a question back in the corner that I can't see because you're in the
room. I've said about my specific question. Do you want me to wait and just ask them later when we're done? Or?
Beneficial to somebody else.
So I apologize. I missed the first few minutes of your presentation. So it's kind of more about you because I don't think anybody else would apply to our situation. We had insurance for the structure. So we have money to rebuild that. We did not have personal property, so we applied to FEMA. They are denying everything, even appeals. Like we don't even have displacement money. They're denying everything for us. We are taking out an SBA loan to get personal property coverage. We did also qualify for the ICC, so we got the $30,000. However, our property to lift it is over double $30,000. Is there any money to make up that? Because we're going to be like $40,000 in the hole.
Yeah, we're just really limited to the structural improvements, putting it back to the pre-flood condition. And if you had to, you said you had to rebuild.
No, we raised.
A raise.
Yep.
And that is actually a question I have into my friends at the state about, can we consider some of those raising costs eligible for this? Generally, they have said no in the past, but it's new people that are running this now, and I've been making the case for some of those mitigation measures that really make sense. Now's the time to do it. If we're putting money into it and this is what they need, we should be doing that. So I haven't heard back from them yet if we could do that. So.
Information for all of you, too. I understand that our house is bigger. It's a primary house. We have an attached garage. However, just to even put it in the air was like $25,000.
Yeah. I had a conversation.
We had to go four courses up.
Yeah. I had a conversation with somebody else.
Garage floor, like it's not.
I had a conversation with somebody else in town that was raising, and they got the $30,000. In flood insurance, but it was $50,000 to raise the property. So
they have to check around. They have to call different house movers if they're getting those prices. Trust me. There's a lot. There's more than one house mover out there.
You know, we got close from everybody.
Some will. Some will. Yes. Some will.
Yep.
It's guaranteed money.
So then have you started work already with lifting?
Yeah, we have.
Okay.
Where are we supposed to live when FEMA won't give us money to go anywhere?
Well, I was just asking, because if you hadn't already started the work, then you could apply for the HMA funds. We did ask FEMA about this, that ICC, the funds that you would be able to go towards that 25% local cost share match. But since you've already started the work, that project type wouldn't meet your particular property wouldn't be eligible. But if anyone else is receiving ICC funds, and if the project gets selected, then you would be able to use that ICC funds to put towards that 25% cost share, that local cost share.
Sorry about that, things are more expensive. That's reinforcing what I've heard in other situations. It's good to have those examples.
We got so many quotes, and that was the cheapest route we could
Because I can tell you that the National Floodplain Association has, at least for 10 years, been lobbying the Congress there to raise that amount and get it to 60 or even 75,000. And that just reinforces the need to have it behind.
At least for
it's,
bigger primary. If it's a small cabin, I recognize it'll be cheaper.
Yeah, and it's been that same $30,000 for, I want to say, 30 years, which obviously prices have gone up. Yeah.
Rich?
Yeah, we have applied for the ICC, and they won't release the money until they have the certificate of elevation, but they wanted a certificate of occupancy. In our case, that wouldn't be till December. And so we haven't gotten any money. We've already incurred all the costs to raise the house, but we can't get any money. We also don't have a penny of FEMA money. We never got our FEMA flood insurance. And it's been now 3 months that somebody making $10 a day on my money, and I can't get it.
So you're saying you made a claim, but they haven't paid you for the damage claim?
Yeah, they claimed that the bank stopped payment. And if everybody's FEMA money is withheld, somebody's making a ton of money. They made $900 just on my
claim. If I can get your contact information afterwards, I can talk to our FEMA flood insurance specialist out of Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah, are rentals considered VRBOs and bed and breakfasts and whatnot, or are rentals where you end up renting month after month after month?
Yeah, for this particular program, it would be an actual rental property, so it's you're renting long term to somebody. It wouldn't be a
Airbnb
or anything Airbnb like that. Yeah, not a temporary. Yeah.
So an Airbnb could be eligible.
No.
Not a temporary rental. Okay. Because you have to pay attention. You have to keep the rents affordable for a period of years. So it has to be a long term rental.
Okay. Just want to thank everybody for coming, and I hope you have received some good information here. And just know that calls to me. I don't have all the answers, but these are the people I've been talking to.
You don't?
Okay. So, just know we're here for you, and we're trying our best to help you. It's not a good situation for anyone to be in. But, so, I just want to thank you all for coming. You guys be sticking around for a little bit in case. Okay, they'll stick around for a little bit in case you want to talk.
So basically, it's just go ahead and fill it out as best I can here back to me. I need to go back to the area.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. So, 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 yeah. So,